John Rourke was moving on knees and elbows, a Detonic Scoremaster in each hand, the guns beginning to coat with ice from the instant he drew them from the full flap holsters at his sides. He was counting seconds. Natalia would be prompt, and the moment the first of the remote probes was launched, John Rourke wanted to be in position, because each second he delayed was a second more, allowing the Nazi defenders here at the mountain summit to realize that the probes were a diversion. Lights were visible from the control station for the mountaintop helipad, as were running lights from the helicopters. Four of these, he judged. That would be enough to get Commander Washington's entire force away from the mountain if none of the machines were too severely damaged, and if there were someplace left to go. The stupidity, the arrogance, the calculated viciousness of Dietrich Zimmer's utilizing a battlefield nuclear weapon was beyond comprehension. A few such detonations and the precarious atmospheric envelope, which had been steadily returning since the Great Conflagration, when the atmosphere ionized and burned, might again be destroyed. 42 seconds had passed since Paul fired the flare. Natalia would be three-quarters of the way to her position, her remote probes ready to launch. The ground was more level here, and Rourke risked moving more rapidly. He was within 20 yards of the helipad, the nearest of the Nazi machines some 10 yards beyond that. Nazi personnel were not, so far, in evidence, but he could still only discern lights, not anything in greater detail because of the darkness and the snow. As he neared, he started to move more cautiously. Ice creepers lashed to the soles of his boots. Paul and Michael wore sets of creepers as well, and the other three men wore improvised versions of the same thing. It was one of the curiosities of this new age that with all the added ice and snow coverage because of drastically reduced global temperatures as a result of the thinning of the atmosphere and the subsequent escape of heat into the blackness of space, no one manufactured ice creepers. He had been introduced to them by his old friend Jerry Bjergel years before the night of the war. Often they had proved invaluable, providing steady footing under otherwise intolerably slick conditions. Had John Rourke been possessed of any entrepreneurial inclinations, a business opportunity of rare potential would have awaited him, assuming, of course, that the entire planet would not be destroyed as a result of Dietrich Zimmer's unconscionable use of nuclear weapons. But because of Dietrich Zimmer's insane ambitions, there were other matters more pressing for John Rourke's mind to ponder at the moment. The video probes, which Natalia had launched, glided overhead toward the Nazi gunships. It would only be a matter of seconds before the reaction started. It was better not to wait. He was within 10 yards of the rear wall of the control building for the helipad. It was logical to assume that many of the Nazi commandos would be huddled inside it against the storm, while only a few unlucky souls waited in the cold and wind. John Rourke holstered his pistols, securing the flaps more as a retention device than as protection, the guns already ice-coated. Instead, he drew the Crane LSX knife, its 12-inch blade worked to a near-razor hone. Rourke quickened his pace, eyes scanning the night for some sign of human activity, and he found it. Still standing, but huddled along the north wall of the building in the full force of the wind, was a sentry. He closed fast and snapped the man's head back. Rourke dragged him back around the corner, quickly wiping the blade clean on the fellow's Arctic gear, then resheathing. Under more relaxed circumstances, Rourke would have made a quick search for papers of potential intelligence value and disabled the weapons he was leaving behind. There was, however, time for neither. Rourke stood, reaching to his sides for the Scoremasters. He reached the far side of the building. There was already movement, men running from their machines, sentries appearing from hiding places taken against the elements, the video probes doing their work. Rourke glanced around the corner of the building, seeing the main entrance. He turned the corner, approaching the entrance, then taking the kickboardless steps two at a time. There was a small porch at their height, and Rourke stopped there. He turned his right hand on the knob. The door flew open with the pressure of the wind. John Rourke stepped through the door. There was a radio man seated on the far side of the room. Another man, on the left side of the single, large room, was securing the hood of his parka. Another man was on the right. Rourke leveled both pistols toward a man courageously charging at him with only a folding camp chair as a weapon. As he worked his way counterclockwise into the room and away from the door, Rourke thrust the pistol, slide-locked back over the empty magazine into his pistol belt, in the same motion sweeping his left hand back to the professional gear holster at his left side beneath the sweater. He popped the thumb brake, freeing one of the two Sig Sauer P-228 9mm, stabbing the pistol toward a young officer trying to escape through the still-open door. The wind tore through the room, maps and other documents scattering about in cyclonic patterns. Rourke moved quickly toward the doorway. Gunfire was everywhere on the helipad, a video probe exploding in midair, whether from enemy gunfire or by remote detonation, he could not be certain. Across the helipad, near one of the Nazi gunships, he could barely make out in the momentary glow a small battle raging. Rourke stepped out onto the porch.